This week, on a special episode of WebMD's Health Discovered podcast, we're taking a closer look at a common form of lung cancer that accounts for 85% of all cases.
When I first heard the words, "you have lung cancer," I was in shock.
It's a diagnosis that changes everything. So what does it really mean to advocate for yourself when you're living with non-small cell lung cancer? Listen to Health Discovered on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
This is a True Crime Today Dark Side Flashback.
William George Bonin, described by the prosecutor at his first trial as the most arch evil person who ever existed. Bonin was convicted of 14 of the murders linked to the freeway killer in two separate trials in 1982 and 83. He spent 14 years on death row before he was executed by lethal injection at San Quentin State Prison in 1996. Bonin became known as the freeway killer due to the fact that the majority of his victims' bodies were discovered alongside numerous freeways in Southern California. He shares this epithet with two separate and unrelated serial killers, Patrick Kearney and Randy Kraft. William Bonin was born in Wilmanic, Connecticut on January 8, 1947, the second of three brothers born to Robert and Alice Bonin. Bonin's parents were alcoholics and his father was a compulsive gambler who was physically abusive towards his wife and children. Bonin and his brothers were severely neglected as children and were often fed and clothed by sympathetic neighbors. In addition, the brothers were often placed in the care of their grandfather, a convicted child molester who had molested Bonin's mother when she had been a child and an adolescent, and who was known to have sexually abused his three grandsons. In 1953, Bonin's mother placed her sons in an orphanage in an effort to protect her children from their father's physical violence. This orphanage was known to severely discipline the children it housed for minor and major breaches of conduct, with the punishments administered including severe beatings, enduring various stress positions, and partial drowning in sinks filled with water. Although Bonin later freely discussed many aspects of his childhood and adolescence, he refused to discuss his memories of the orphanage beyond divulging that he consented to sexual advances from older males only if they would first tie his hand behind his back. He was to remain at the orphanage until the age of 9, when he returned to live with his parents in the town of Mansfield. At the age of 10, Bonin was arrested for stealing vehicle license plate and was placed in a juvenile detention center for various minor crimes. While housed at this juvenile detention center, he was repeatedly physically and sexually abused by several people, including his adult counselor. 4 years later, in 1961, facing the prospect of the foreclosure of their home, Bonin's parents opted to relocate to California. The Bonin family settled in a modest home on Angel Street in the city of Downey. Shortly thereafter, Bonin's father died from cirrhosis of the liver. While living at this address, Bonin is known to have molested his younger brother and several neighborhood children. Many of these children were lured into Bonin's home with the promise of alcohol, and all his known victims were younger than he was. In addition to these acts of molestation, Bonin is known to have committed several acts of robbery, petty theft, and grand theft in his teenage years. Shortly after graduating from high school in 1965, Bonin became engaged to Mary. This engagement had largely been at the behest of his mother, who was believed the prospect of the marriage would quell her son's evident homosexuality. The same year of his graduation, Bonin joined the U.S. Air Force. He later served 5 months of active duty in the Vietnam War as an aerial gunner, logging over 700 hours of combat and patrol time. Bonin was later claimed his experiences in Vietnam had instilled a belief with him that human life is overvalued. On one occasion, while under enemy fire, he risked his own life to save the life of a wounded fellow airman. For this act, Bonin received a Medal of Recognition for his gallantry. Bonin later claimed to have engaged in consensual sexual relations with males and females in Vietnam. He also later admitted to sexually assaulting two fellow soldiers at gunpoint during the period of the Tet Offense. Bonin served 3 years in the U.S. Air Force before he received an honorable discharge in October of 1968. Upon his discharge, Bonin returned to Downey to live with his mother. Shortly thereafter, he married his fiancée, and the couple soon divorced. So here we go. It's the dark side of Wikipedia. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. We greatly appreciate that. Tony and Sean on today's episode. It's a guy where you were getting the recipe for everything that made him. And I guess the next things we hear about shouldn't be that much of a surprise, or should they?
What is the part about he wanted his arms behind his back before he would do deplorable acts?
I guess so.
Huh.
When he was a kid, he was 9 or younger at the
time.
Like,
I'll do it, or I'll let that be done to me, but please put my arms behind my back first.
I guess, but okay. I don't know. I mean, you're a kid, you don't know why this is happening, or this is, you know, you're trying to normalize things and nothing is normal of anything that was going on there.
If you can picture this handsome devil as William Bonin is in a low budget, late 70s adult film.
Mm-hmm.
Very healthy mustache.
Is that how he looks?
Yes.
Rocking the stash.
Yeah. So, this gentleman is all that and a bag of apples.
It's one of those things where it's like, you know, he could have gone into a promising career of porn or something,
right,
and just ended up, you know, dying of cirrhosis of the liver like his father did. But no, he went down a very different path. It just gets darker from here, if it wasn't dark enough already.
I got my popcorn.
So as we continue into the story of William George Bonin here on the dark side of Wikipedia. On November 17th, 1968, at age 21, Bonin committed a sexual assault on a youth. He was to commit 3 further sexual assaults upon boys and youths over the following 4 months. The victims of these 4 assaults were aged between 12 and 18. In each instance, he bound or otherwise restricted his victim before forcibly engaging in sodomy, oral copulation, and methods of torture, which included bludgeoning and the squeezing of his victim's testicles. In early 1969, Bonin was arrested as he attempted to restrain a 16-year-old youth whom he had lured into his vehicle. He was indicted of 5 counts of kidnapping, 4 counts of sodomy, 1 count of oral copulation, and 1 count of child molestation against the 5 youths he had abducted or assaulted, or in the case of the final youth he had abducted, attempted assault since the previous November. Bonin pled guilty to molestation and forced oral copulation and was sentenced to the Asadero State Hospital as a mentally disordered sexual offender considered amiable to treatment in January of 1971. While detained at this hospital, Bonin was subjected to a battery of psychiatric examinations, which revealed that he possessed a higher than average IQ of 121 and displayed traits of manic depression in addition to damage to the prefrontal cortex of his brain, which would likely reduce his ability to restrain any violent impulses. Bonin's physical examinations also revealed extensive scars on his head and buttocks, which he had likely sustained in the 3 years he had been housed at the Connecticut Juvenile Detention Center, although he claimed to have no memory of any such incidents of abuse. 2 years after his arrival at the Atestero State Hospital, Bonin was sent to prison, declared unsuitable for further treatment, largely due to his repeatedly engaging in forceful sexual activity with male inmates. On June 11, 1974, he was released from prison after doctors concluded he was no longer a danger to the health and safety of others. Further offenses and imprisonment. On September 8, 1974, Bonin encountered a 14-year-old named David Allen McVicker hitchhiking in Garden Grove. McVicker accepted Bonin's offer to drive him to his parents' home in Huntington Beach. Shortly after McVicker had entered Bonin's vehicle, he was taken attacked by Bonin, asked back by Bonin, rather, asking him if he was gay. When McVicker asked Bonin to stop his car, Bonin produced a gun and drove the youth to a deserted field where he ordered McVicker to undress, then beat and raped him. After beating and assaulting McVicker, Bonin began to strangle the youth with his own T-shirt, then immediately became apologetic when McVicker began screaming. He then drove McVicker home before casually stating, "We'll meet again." McVicker immediately informed his mother of the rape. She in turn notified Garden Grove police. Shortly thereafter, Bonin was charged with the rape and forcible oral copulation of a minor and the attempted abduction of a 15-year-old, which had occurred 2 days after Bonin had assaulted McVicker. In his second instance, Bonin had sexually propositioned a 15-year-old who had rejected Bonin's offer of $35 for sex. In response, Bonin had attempted to strike the youth with his vehicle. Bonin pled guilty to these charges, and on December 31, 1975, he was sentenced to serve between 1 and 15 years imprisonment to be served at the California Men's Facility in San Luis Obispo. He was released from the detention center on October 11, 1978, albeit with 18 months supervised probation. Upon his release, Bonin moved to an apartment complex in Downey, approximately 1 mile from his mother's home, and soon found employment as a truck driver for a Montebello delivery firm named Dependable Driveaway. He also established a reputation among teenage boys in his neighborhood as a gregarious individual who allowed them to socialize in his apartment and who bought alcohol from minors. In addition, Bonin dated a young woman whom he informed acquaintances he regularly accompanied to Anaheim on Sundays to partake in her hobby of roller skating. Shortly after moving to his apartment, Bonin became acquainted with a 43-year-old neighbor named Everett Frazier. Bonin became a regular attendee at the frequent parties Frazier held at his apartment, and through these social gatherings, he became acquainted with a 21-year-old named Vernon Butts and an 18-year-old named Gregory Miley. Butts, a porcelain factory worker and part-time magician who had held a fascination with occultism, later claimed to have been both fascinated with and terrified of Bonin, while freely admitting to taking a great delight in watching Bonin abuse and torture his victims. Miley, an illiterate Texas native with an IQ of 56, who supported himself with casual work, also actively participated in the murders he accompanied Bonin upon. Bonin usually selected young male hitchhikers, schoolboys, or occasionally male prostitutes as his victims. The victims, aged 12 to 19, were either enticed or forced into his Ford Econoline van, where they were overpowered and bound hand and foot with a combination of handcuffs and wire or cords. They were then sexually assaulted, extensively beaten about the face, head, and genitals, and tortured before typically being killed by strangulation with their own T-shirts, although some victims were stabbed or battered to death. One victim, Darren Kendrick, was forced to drink hydraulic acid. Three victims had ice picks driven into their ears. Another victim, Mark Shelton, died of shock. In order to minimize the chances of a potential victim escaping from his vehicle, Bonin removed all inner handles from the passenger side and rear doors of his van and stowed ligatures, knives, household tools, and other instruments in his vehicle to facilitate the restraining and torture of his victims. The victims were usually killed inside his van before the bodies were discarded alongside or close to various freeways in Southern California. In a minimum of 12 of the murders, Bonin was assisted by one or more of his four known accomplices. According to one attorney present throughout Bonin's subsequent confession, the escalating levels of brutality he had exhibited towards his victims had been similar to that of a drug addict, requiring an even greater increase of dosage to attain a satisfactory level of euphoria. And Bonin later emphasized to neurologist he had felt an intense sense of excitement as he searched for his victims. The first murder for which Bonin was charged was that of a 13-year-old hitchhiker named Thomas Glenn Lundgren. Lundgren was last seen leaving his parents' home in Reseda at 10:50 a.m. on the morning of May 28, 1979. His body, clad only in a T-shirt, shoes, and socks, and was found the same afternoon in Agora. An autopsy revealed that Lundgren had suffered emasculation and bludgeoning to his face and head, with his skull sustaining multiple fractures. In addition, the youth had been slashed across the throat, extensively stabbed, and strangled to death. His underwear, jeans, and several severed genitals were discovered strewn in a field close to his body. In the abduction and murder of Lundgren, Bonin was assisted by Butts, who is suspected of accompanying or assisting Bonin on at least 8 further murders attributed to the Freeway Killer. In mid-1979, Bonin was again arrested for molesting a 17-year-old boy in the coastal community of Dana Point. This violation of the conditions of his parole should have resulted in Bonin being returned to prison. However, an administrative error committed prior to Bonin's scheduled court date resulted in his release. Frazier drove to collect Bonin from the Orange County Jail where he had been incarcerated. He later recollected that as he drove Bonin home, Bonin made a statement which he, Frazier, had interpreted as the time as an expression of remorse. "No one's going to testify again. This is never going to happen to me again." 2 months later, the murder of Lundgren, on August 4, 1979, Bonin and Butts abducted a 17-year-old named Mark Shelton shortly after the youth left his Westminster home to walk to a movie theater near Beach Boulevard. Screams were heard from the vicinity of Shelton's household by neighbors, leaving a strong possibility Shelton was abducted by force. The youth was violated with foreign objects, including a pool cue, causing his body to enter a state of shock which proved fatal. His body was then discarded in San Bernardino County. The following day, Bonin and Butts encountered a 17-year-old West German student named Marcus Grabs attempting to hitchhike from Pacific Coast Highway. Grabs was bound with lengths of cord and ignition wire and driven to Bonin's home, where he was sodomized, beaten, and stabbed a total of 77 times before his nude body was discarded in Malibu Creek close to Las Virginias Canyon Road. His body was found the following morning with one investigator linking the network of injuries inflicted upon the victim to that of a rabid dog unable to determine when to cease biting. And I gotta say, the spree just keeps going, and we can continue on with that in a moment, but thoughts thus far on this big pile of wrong.
Well, I noticed that the names Butts, Grabs.
I know.
Like, goodness.
It's almost like they were stage porn names, but these are just these people's names.
You just got to change your name, man. If you don't want to get a pool cue stuck up your yin yang, you should probably become a Williams or a Smith. That's how telling is that, where a investigator compares the victim to a dog that bit them that didn't know when to stop biting. I mean, that's a lot of times being 77. My gosh, like, why?
Well, I mean, they obviously sounded like they were into mutilating the bodies and such as well. So I guess they got some sort of fucked up thrill out of it.
Just, I mean, not to say that some of these stories that we can kind of understand a place where they're at in the case of if somebody continuously kills females that specifically had blonde hair. Well, maybe it was for a past girlfriend or mom issues or some type of relevance that we can understand.
Some sort of abuse or something, yeah.
The rage that we would feel. But then there's some situations and stories like this where, okay, like you're mad or you get some weird enjoyment, but to the extent that this stuff occurs or what is happening to these victims is just, my gosh, next level carnage.
There's no putting yourself in this person's shoes and saying, oh yeah, I get it. I don't. There's no getting this one. This is just like, what the fuck? Hey, Billy, go grab that pool cue over there. Yeah, bring it over to me. What are we going to do with it? Well, that guy that we murdered, let's have some fun. I mean, what
we're
the fuck?
We're going to put it in
him. What the fuck? So let's continue on as we learn more about William George Bonin. I wonder if he has a marked grave or if that's just kind of like, nope, that didn't work out. On August 27th, Bonin and Butts abducted a 15-year-old Hollywood youth named Donald Ray Hayden. Hayden was last seen alive walking along Santa Monica Boulevard at 1 a.m. His body was found by construction workers later the same morning in a dumpster located near the off-ramp of the Ventura Freeway. Prior to his death by ligature strangulation, Hayden had been bound, beaten about the face, sodomized, then stabbed in the neck and genitalia, and bludgeoned about the skull. Evident attempts had also been made to remove his testicles and slash his throat. 2 weeks after the murder of Hayden, on September 9th, Bonin and Butts encountered a 17-year-old Mareda youth named David Lewis Morello cycling to a movie theater. Morello was lured into Bonin's van, where he was bound, repeatedly raped, extensively bludgeoned about the skull with a tire iron, then strangled with the ligature before his nude body was thrown over an embankment into a bed of ivy alongside Highway 101. 8 days after the murder of Morello on September 17th, an 18-year-old Newport Beach youth named Robert Christopher Riosteck was abducted as he cycled to his job at a grocery store. His body was found on September 27th along the interstate. Bonin is not known to have killed again on or about until about November 1st, when he and Butts abducted and murdered an unidentified young man approximately 5'10" in height and estimated to be between ages 19 and 25 years old. The victim was savagely beaten, then strangled to death before his body was discarded in an irrigation ditch alongside State Route 99 south of Bakersfield. Although never identified, Bonin later estimated the age of his victim to be 23 and freely admitted to inserting an ice pick into the victim's nostrils and ear prior to his murder. Approximately 4 weeks later, Bonin, operating alone, abducted and strangled a 17-year-old Bellflower youth named Frank Dennis Fox. His body was found 2 days later alongside the Ortega Highway, 5 miles east of San Juan Capistrano. The body itself bore signs of extensive blunt force trauma to the face and head, with ligature marks on the wrists and ankles indicating Fox had been bound throughout the ordeal. No clothing or other identifying evidence was discovered at the scene. 10 days after the murder of Fox, a 15-year-old Long Beach youth named John Frederick Kilpatrick disappeared after leaving his parents' home to socialize with friends. Kilpatrick was strangled to death before his body was discarded in a remote area of Rialto. His body was found on December 13th. Kilpatrick remained known as a John Doe until August 5th, 1980. On January 1st, 1980, Bonin brutalized and strangled a 16-year-old Ontario youth named Michael Francis McDonald. His fully clothed body was found alongside Highway 71 in West San Bernardino County 2 days after his murder, although his body was not identified until March 24th. On February 3rd, Bonin drove from Downey to Hollywood in the company of 18-year-old Miley, with the specific intention of committing a further murder. The pair encountered a 15-year-old named Charles Miranda standing close to the Starwood nightclub, hitchhiking alongside Santa Monica Boulevard. According to Miley, Bonin and Miranda engaged in consensual sexual activity in the rear of the van as he drove, before Bonin then whispered to Miley, "Kid's gonna die." Miranda was then overpowered and bound by Bonin, who then asked the youth how much money he had in his possession. When Miranda responded he had about $6, Bonin ordered Miley to take the youth's wallet before raping the victim. Miley also attempted to rape the youth but was unable to sustain an erection. In frustration, Miley assaulted Miranda with various sharp objects before assisting Bonin in beating the youth. Bonin then strangled Miranda to death with a t-shirt and tire iron as Miley repeatedly jumped on Miranda's chest. His nude corpse was then dumped into an alleyway alongside East 2nd Street in Los Angeles. 5 minutes after the pair had discarded Miranda's body, Bonin suggested to Miley, "I'm horny again. Let's go and do another one." A few hours later, in Huntington Beach, the pair encountered a 12-year-old named James McCabe at a bus stop on the corner of Beach Boulevard and Slater Avenue. McCabe was lured into Bonin's van on the promise he would be driven to his intended destination of Disneyland. According to Miley, the boy entered the rear of the van voluntarily as Bonin drove to a grocery store parking lot where he parked the van and entered the rear of the vehicle. Miley then drove in an aimless manner for what he later described as being a very, very long distance. As he drove, Miley continually heard McCabe crying as Bonin beat and raped him before forcing the boy to sleep in his arms. Miley then joined Bonin in beating the child and crushing his neck with a tire iron simply because he felt like doing so. Bonin then strangled McCabe to death with his own t-shirt before the pair discarded his fully clothed, beaten body alongside a dumpster in the city of Walnut. McCabe's body was found 3 days later. On February 4th, Bonin was arrested for violating the conditions of his parole. He was remanded in custody at the Orange County Jail until March 4th. 10 days after Bonin had been released from custody on March 14th, he abducted and killed an 18-year-old Van Nuys youth named Ronald Gatlin. Gatlin was abducted shortly after he had left a friend's home. He was beaten, sodomized, and suffered several deep perforating ice pick wounds to the ear and neck before being strangled with a ligature. Gatlin's body, bound hand and foot, was found the following day in the city of Duarte. 1 week later, on March 21st, Bonin lured a 14-year-old named Glenn Baker into his van as the youth hitchhiked to school. Baker was also raped, beaten, and strangled to death with a ligature. His body also bore evidence of numerous burns to the neck, which had been inflicted with a lit cigarette. In addition, Baker had been violated with foreign objects, which had extensively dissented his rectum. At 4 p.m. the same day, a 15-year-old named Russell Ruff was abducted from a bus stop in Garden Grove. Ruff was bound, beaten, and strangled to death after an estimated 8 hours of captivity before his body was discarded along that area of Barker in Cleveland National Forest. The youth's nude bodies were found on March 23rd. On Friday evening, March 1980, Bonin offered a 17-year-old named William Ray Pooh a ride home as the pair left Frazier's residence. Within minutes of accepting the ride, Bonin asked Pooh whether he would like to engage in sex with him. Pooh later stated he panicked and stuttered upon hearing this question, and after sitting in silence for several minutes, attempted to leave the vehicle once Bonin had slowed the van at a stoplight. In response, Bonin wordlessly leaned across, grabbed Pooh by the collar, dragged him back into the passenger seat. According to Pooh, Bonin then confided in him that he enjoyed abducting young male hitchhikers on Friday and Saturday nights, whom he then restrained, abused before strangling them to death with their own T-shirts. In a matter-of-fact tone, Bonin then informed Pooh, if you want to kill somebody, you could make a plan and find a place to dump the body before you even pick the victim. Bonin then informed Pooh that he had not chosen to refrain from assaulting and killing him out of sentiment. He'd been spared because the pair had been seen leaving Frazier's party together. Pooh was driven to his home without being assaulted. Well, it's good to have plans. Friday, Saturday night, some people like to go to the club. Some people like to go to the movies. Some like to just stay at home and watch a game on TV. This guy likes to go abduct male youths and take them to the back of his van and do horrific things with them.
Hey, Bill, 2-for-1 PBR tonight, maybe some pool? Nah, I'm going to go grab Joey's testicles and then kill him.
I might throw it out the window on the 101.
But hey, if you're available after 9:30, get me a little rum and coke.
Jesus Christ.
I may
Christ.
Have to leave again at 10 because I like to do twofers. I like to, you know, I get pretty excited pretty quickly. Recovery
oh,
time.
Oh, God.
And so I'm going to get grab. I'm going to get butts. I'm going to get poo. Maybe I'm going to get a Johnson. And doesn't Michael Wiener have a child? Let's go with that, too.
It's like he just goes. The thing is, he's picking up these people at random off of the road. It's not like he looked them up in the phone book. They all just happen to have names, or many had names that seemed to have some sort of innuendo about them.
What's crazy and interesting is anybody with passion and consistency and the know-how and the willpower to stay in that moment and to continue to perfect your craft, doesn't matter if you're an engineer or a fighter pilot or a killer of young boys. I mean, he was succeeding in what his plan was.
Yeah.
Which is really screwed up. But to think in that regard, why would they become more vanilla? Why would they become, oh, well, he didn't really do anything that bad. He just killed him.
I'm amazed. I mean, just the fact that, you know, he was caught and let out so many times for rape and things of that nature. And it was such like a slap on the wrist every time. It's like, you know, let's stop. We don't believe he's not a harm to anybody. And then like 2 days later, he's out with his fucking van again. So I would hope that there's more safeguards out there these days. I think there are in terms of sexual predators. And this is, you know, people like him are probably why they eventually said, you know, nope, you're on this list now forever. You got to let everybody know who you are everywhere you live. And, you know, there's a lot more monitoring that goes on of this than did circa 1979. But I don't know. I mean, is it because we have more safeguards in place now that we don't necessarily hear stories like this that frequently anymore?
I think it's twofold. I think there is so much surveillance and sadly, there's really no preventative for this to happen once,
yeah,
maybe twice. But I think by that point, whether it be surveillance, whether it be social media, whether it be tracking of your iPhone, I mean,
yeah,
this person would be detained. Also, I think you can get what you couldn't get back in the 70s was that thrill and that adrenaline rush of doing something so fucking insane without actually doing it. Whereas now in 2021, in the world of virtual reality and I mean, clearly the virtual world that we all lived in last year, but
yeah.
you can have such a sadistic pleasure and do it in the comfort of your own one bedroom apartment. You don't actually have to go find people and do it.
Well, it makes me wonder a little bit because I'm being serious here. So many people will look at things, games, things like Grand Theft Auto and things like that and be like, oh my God, that is contributing to the downfall of society. Is it? Or things like that, have those sort of things given an outlet to angry young males that we read about here on Dark Side of Wikipedia that were highly active in the 60s, 70s, 80s? And we don't necessarily see, we certainly see horrible people all the time, but things like this, you know, they're not that common anymore. I mean, they're out there, but the sprees and all of that were like this sort of shit. Has the world changed? Do people use that as an outlet now who otherwise would have gone and harmed someone? Or does it give people who are going to harm someone ideas? I guess it's the chicken before the egg, and you can make arguments on either side of that.
Yeah, I think it's 50-50. I think the short answer is yes to all the above.
Yeah.
Because I would imagine on a case-by-case basis, somebody that was choosing to actually do this in real life can then do it virtually, and vice versa. Somebody that wouldn't even think of doing such a heinous act gets hooked on a game and then wants to elevate the thrill even more.
Yeah.
And they go carjack someone and try to do something, and hopefully police get in the way and prevent them from actually doing more harm.
Why can't we just go back to good old Mortal Kombat? Just, you know, when that was the one that everybody was freaking out. Because, I mean, luckily, that's never turned into reality. We haven't had a spree of ninjas that are named Scorpion and Sub-Zero and all of that running around the world. And you know, throwing spears at people and ice balls and, you know, all of that. And that was the big concern about Mortal Kombat. I guess GTA is the one that has come more to life than that.
Yet, Tony, give it time. There will be Wolverine people with 18-inch claws on their hands going during the streets of downtown soon enough.
And then just suddenly from the balcony of a building, someone yells, "Round one, fight!" And then fatality. It's a sign of things to come for 2021, everybody.
Really excited.
You just never know what you're going to get. So let's continue here into the story of good old WGB. On March 24th, Bonin and Pooh abducted a 15-year-old runaway named Harry Todd Turner from a Los Angeles street. Turner had absconded from a boy's home in the desert community of Lancaster 4 days prior to his meeting Bonin and Pooh. Pooh was later to testify that he and Bonin lured Turner into Bonin's van with an offer of $20 for sex. After binding, sodomizing, and biting the youth, Bonin ordered Pooh to beat him. After Pooh had bludgeoned and beat Turner about the head and body for several minutes, Bonin strangled the youth to death with his own t-shirt before discarding his body at the rear delivery door to a Los Angeles business. Turner's autopsy subsequently revealed the youth's genitals had been mutilated and he had received a total of 8 fractures to the skull inflicted by a blunt instrument before he had been strangled. On the afternoon of April 10th, Bonin abducted a 16-year-old Bellflower youth named Stephen John Wood. As the youth walked to school, having attended a dental appointment that morning, his nude, extensively beaten body was discarded at an alleyway in Long Beach, close to the Pacific Coast Highway. No clothing or other identifying evidence was discovered at the scene. Wood's autopsy revealed the youth had been killed by ligature strangulation. 3 weeks later, on April 29th, while parked in the grounds of Stratton Supermarket, Bonin and Butch lured a 19-year-old employee named Darren Kendrick to Bonin's van on a pretext of selling the youth drugs. Kendrick was driven to Butt's apartment, where he was overpowered and bound by both men. In addition to enduring sodomy and partial ligature strangulation, Kendrick was forced to drink hydraulic acid by Bonin, causing caustic chemical burns to his mouth, chin, stomach, and chest. Butts then drove an ice pick into Kendrick's ear, causing a fatal wound to the youth's cervical spine cord. His body was discarded behind a warehouse close to the Arista Freeway. With the ice pick, Butts had driven into his skull, still protruding from his ear. On May 12th, Bonin abducted and murdered a 17-year-old acquaintance of his, whom he later stated he had decided to kill when he had awoken that morning because he was tired of having him around. The body of his acquaintance, Lauren Sharp, was discarded behind a Westminster gas station. His body was found on May 18th, and his autopsy revealed that in addition to being bound and sodomized, Sharp had been extensively beaten about the face and body, then strangled with a ligature. 1 week after the murder of Sharp on May 19th, Bonin asked Butts to accompany him on a killing. On this occasion, however, Butts reportedly refused to accompany him. Operating alone, Bonin abducted a 14-year-old Southgate youth named Sean King from a bus stop in Downey, killed him, then discarded his body on Live Oak Canyon, Yucapa. Bonin then visited Butts' residence and bragged of the killings to his accomplice. 9 days after the murder of King, Bonin invited an 18-year-old homeless drifter named James Michael Murno to move into the apartment he shared with his mother. Murno had been evicted from his family's home in his native Michigan in early 1980 and had been living rough on the streets of Hollywood for several weeks. As such, Murno readily accepted Bonin's accommodation offer. As he earlier had been the case with Miley, Murno, a bisexual who preferred sexual relations with females, also began a consensual sexual relationship with Bonin. He also accepted a subsequent offer of employment at the Montebello delivery firm where Bonin worked. Murno later described his initial impression of Bonin as being a good guy, really normal. Although on the evening of June 1st, Bonin abruptly informed Murno he wanted them to abduct, rape, and kill a teenage hitchhiker. By early 1980, the murders committed by the freeway killer were receiving considerable media attention and a reward totaling $50,000 for information leading to the conviction of the perpetrator or perpetrators had been offered by the leading gay rights activists. Bonin avidly collected newspaper clippings documenting his own manhunt. Having by this stage determined a definitive link between many of the murders committed with the previous year, investigators from the various jurisdictions were victims that had been abducted or discovered had themselves begun sharing information in their collective hunt for the perpetrator. Six officers from three of the jurisdictions in which the freeway killer had most regularly either abducted or deposited the bodies of his victims formed a task force dedicated to the apprehension of the suspect or suspects who, as one of the officers upon this assembled task force later recalled, was striking at an average rate of once every 2 weeks in the spring of 1980. By May 1980, Pooh had been arrested for auto theft and was housed at the Los Pardenos Juvenile Courthouse. On May 29th, Pooh overheard the details of the ongoing murders on a local radio broadcast and confided to a counselor his recognition of the perpetrator's modus operandi as being that described to him by Bonin 2 months previous. This counselor reported Pooh's suspicions to the police, who in turn relayed this information to an LAPD homicide sergeant named John St. John. Upon hearing the confidential tip from the counselor, St. John conducted an extensive interview with Pooh, although Pooh withheld the fact that he had actually accompanied Bonin on one of his murders. The information helped led St. John to deduce that Bonin may have indeed been the freeway killer. McVicker had also contacted authorities by this time to report his suspicions that Bonin may be the perpetrator. His suspicions were not dismissed, but regarded as one of many public tips to be investigated. A police investigation into Bonin's background revealed his extensive history of convictions for sexually assaulting teenage boys. Detective John St. John assigned a surveillance team to monitor Bonin's movements. The surveillance of Bonin began on the evening of June 2nd, 1980. On June 2nd, the same day as police surveillance began, Bonin, accompanied by James Murno, encountered an 18-year-old print shop worker named Stephen J. Wells standing at a bus stop on El Segundo Boulevard. Bonin and Murno enticed the youth into the van. Upon learning Wells was bisexual, Bonin persuaded the youth to accompany him to his apartment on the promise he would be paid $200 if he allowed himself to be bound prior to engaging in sex. At Bonin's apartment, Wells was bound, raped, beaten about the face and torso, then informed he was to be murdered before he was strangled to death with his own T-shirt. Bonin then placed Wells' body inside a cardboard box, which he and Murnau then carried to his van. The pair then drove to the residence of Butts, whom Bonin first interviewed or invited to view Wells' body with the excitement, "We got it in the van. It's a good one. Come on out and see it." According to Murnau, upon viewing the body, Butts replied, "Oh, you got another one." Before Bonin asked for advice as to how to dispose of it, at Bonin's subsequent trial, Murnau recalled Butts' response, "Try a gas station, like, or where, I don't know which. We dumped the last one." Murnau also later testified that Butts had actively dissuaded Bonin from discharging the youth's body in the nearby canyons due to the late hour. Wells' body was instead discarded behind a disguised Huntington Beach gas station, where it was found 5 hours later. After 9 days of surveillance, on June 11, 1980, police observed Bonin driving in a seemingly random manner throughout Hollywood, unsuccessfully attempting to lure 5 separate teenage boys into his van. Before succeeding in luring a youth into his vehicle, the police followed Bonin until his van parked in a desolate parking lot close to the Hollywood freeway, then discreetly approached the vehicle. Upon hearing muffled screams and banging sounds emanating from inside the van, the plainclothes officers forced their way into the vehicle, discovering Bonin in the act of raping a 17-year-old Orange County runaway named Harold Eugene Tate, whom he had handcuffed and bound. Initially charged with the rape of a minor and held on suspicion of murder of Miranda, Bonin was detained in lieu of $25,000 bond. The following day, Murnau stole Bonin's car and fled to his native Michigan. Inside Bonin's van, investigators discovered numerous artifacts attesting to his culpability in the freeway killer murders. These items include various restraining devices, including lengths of nylon cord, an assortment of knives, a tire iron, and household implements such as pliers and coat hangers. Furthermore, the interior of Bonin's van and sections of his home were extensively bloodstained, and the inner handles from the passenger side of the rear doors of his vehicle had been removed in an obvious effort to prevent victims from escaping the vehicle. Inside the glove box, investigators also discovered a scrapbook of newspaper clippings related to the murders. It's good that he reads news, and he's up on the current happenings of the day, and he's clipping them out. Maybe he's getting some coupons, too. 2-for-1 on bananas down at the Pomida.
So I'm told if I use this coupon in person, I get the Pooh and the Harry thrown in.
And the John St. John.
What is it? Ooh, look, we got a good one. Like, he's referencing we're fishing, but when we're not looking for bass, we're looking for teenage victims that we're going to kill and do stuff with.
Yeah, that appears to kind of be how he rolled with it.
Mm. I mean, I would like to bring somebody on that is maybe a chronic gambler or does a lot of betting on sporting events.
Mm-hmm.
And just try to figure out what in their brain has them addicted, that they roll the dice. Because if you put $200 down, you could lose it. Mm-hmm. But the allure of putting X amount of money down that you could win then $5,000-$10,000. Similarly, if you have this interest in doing sadistic things to another human, yeah, you could do it and not get caught, or you could do it and, like, you know, get arrested and ultimately killed. Like, what in your brain, the pros outweigh the cons or the cons outweigh the pros? Or I would just like to get, and the only thing I can compare doing such crazy things is that of a chronic gambler on a similar level.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously not murder, but you're talking in terms of thinking,
trying the brain.
Yeah, trying to understand that.
Yeah,
you know, I get, you know, addiction to things like substance addiction. I can understand that. But I and it's not that I'm saying this isn't a thing, because it certainly is and people suffer from it, but I've never understood the gambling one. I guess my brain is not addictive in that way to, I guess, actions that are where I could lose money. That one I've just never... It's never been a lure to me. Like, I don't mind going to a casino every now and then and playing a little bit, but I'm very conservative with it because I'm losing money. And I would like to try and understand that. Is it the rush? Is it the high? It must be something to do with that you're getting such a high, or the individual who has that is feeling something that we are not, that it's activating something in their brain, and it's a much stronger high than what I would feel for doing the same thing. I guess the same with like alcohol or drugs or whatever it may be. Certain people will have different reactions to different things that will drive them, and they're getting a different feeling than others that drives them back to it much stronger than one who would not have the addictive thing going on with them. But that is genetic there. So I guess I kind of have to try and understand it from that perspective. But that's just one I've never felt.
I got nothing. No. I too, not of that mindset. Pizza, yes. Chocolate chip cookies, yes.
Yeah.
Why, Sean? Why do you eat the whole pizza opposed to three or four slices? Because it's good. So, and I'm okay being a male and feeling pregnant. I'm okay with that because I know it'll suffice in about 24 hours. But
yeah,
that's as close as I get of the addictive. Maybe having a bit too much of something that you shouldn't have too much of.
Yeah, that's just one of those things. It's it would be interesting to talk to someone and to hear their perspective to better understand that. I mean, talking to a killer, it's not usually an easy thing to do. But he does make a confession, and he does end up going to prison. And that's what we're going to be covering in the final chapter of the William George Bonin story. If you'd like to hear the final chapter, become what we call a Darksider. You can sign up for that at darksideofwiki.com. Click Become a Darksider. You'll get access to the final chapter in the story, as well as access to all of our episodes, all commercial free, and all of our final chapters. We just started doing these a couple episodes ago, and going forward, we're going to be doing them. So you also get advanced episodes of the show as well, months before they're released to the general public. It's only $5 a month. Dark Side of Wiki is where you go. Click Become a Darksider. And support our program. That is what is keeping us on the air. So we'll see you for the final chapter with our Darksiders over there. Until next time, for Sean and all of us at Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening. Although initially protesting his innocence in any of the murders, Bonin confessed to his guilt to St. John after reading an impassioned letter from the mother of King, imploring him to reveal the location of her son's body. Over the course of several evenings, Bonin confessed to abducting, raping, and killing 21 boys and young men. He expressed no remorse for his actions, but he did demonstrate extreme embarrassment and regret over having been caught. His primary accomplice throughout his killing spree, Bonin stated, had been Butts, with Miley and Murno being active accomplices in other murders. Bonin later told one reporter who asked him what he would be doing if he were still at large, I'd be killing. I couldn't stop killing. It got easier with each one we did. Bonin was physically linked to many of the murders by blood and semen stains and numerous distinctive green Turkskellian-shaped carpet fibers found upon seven of the victims' bodies, which were forensically proven to be a precise match with the carpeting in the rear of Bonin's van. Furthermore, upon three victims' bodies, investigators had discovered hair samples, which had proven to be a precise match with Bonin. Medical evidence also revealed that six of the murders for which Bonin was charged were committed by a unique windlass strangulation method, which was referred to by the prosecutor at Bonin's Los Angeles County trial as a signature, a trademark. Initially formally arraigned for the murder of Grabs on July 25th, by July 29th, Bonin had been charged with an additional 15 murders to which he had confessed and upon which the prosecution believed they had sufficient evidence to obtain a conviction. In addition to the 16 murder indictments, Bonin was also charged with 11 counts of robbery, one count of sodomy, and one count of mayhem. He was held without bond, and on August 8th, these charges were formally submitted against him. 3 days later, in accordance with the Penal Code Section 987, Bonin, at the stage, without legal representation, was appointed an attorney named Earl Hansen to act as his legal representative. Hansen remained Bonin's attorney until October 1981, when at Bonin's request, he was replaced by William Charvet and Tracy Stewart. Based on Bonin's confession, police obtained a warrant authorizing a search of Butts' Lakewood property on the same date as Bonin's initial arraignment. This July 25th search uncovered evidence linking Butts to several of the murders to which Bonin had already confessed, and Butts was brought before a municipal court on July 29th, charged with accompanying Bonin on six murders committed between August 79 and April 1980. He was also charged with three counts of robbery. and a press statement relating to the police investigation into the murders issued. On this date, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department stated, Bonin and Butts are believed to be responsible for the kidnapping, torture, and murder of at least 21 young males between May of 1979 and June 1980, before adding that five further murder charges would likely be filed against the men in Orange County. Despite proclaiming his innocence, Buss confessed to having accompanied Bonin upon each of the murder forays in each of the charges listed against him, and to have actively participated in the sexual abuse of several victims. Butts was adamant that he had only a limited role in the torture of the victims, but confessed to actively participating in the torture of one victim. Butts claimed he typically drove in an aimless manner as Bonin abused and tortured his victims in the rear of the van, then stopped the vehicle in order to assist in restraining the victim as Bonin escalated the torture. When asked as to why some victims had been subjected to more extensive blunt force trauma than others, Butts stated that in many instances, Bonin would escalate the level of beatings to which he subjected his victims if the youth resisted his sexual advances. Butts was brought before Orange County Municipal Court Judge Richard Orcazo on November 14, 1980. On this date, he was formally charged with participating in three further murders committed in this county. His trial was scheduled for July 27, 1981. On July 31st, Murnau was arrested in his hometown of Port Huron, Michigan. He was extradited to California, charged with the murder of Wells. Murnau pleaded innocent to all charges against him on August 14th. On August 22nd, Miley, by this stage 19 years old, was arrested in Texas and subsequently charged by California authorities with the murders of Miranda and McCobb. Miley was arrested after having confessed to his culpability in these February 3rd murders in a recorded phone conversation with a friend, thus substantiating Bonin's earlier confession. He initially pleaded innocent to two charges of first-degree murder on December 18th, but pleaded guilty at two separate pretrial hearings in May of 1981. At a preliminary hearing held in Los Angeles County before Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Julius Letham on January 2nd, Bonin formally pled his innocence to 14 first-degree murder charges and numerous counts of sodomy, robbery, and mayhem. In 11 of these indictments, a felony murder robbery special circumstance was also alleged. He was ordered to return to court on January 7th for pretrial motions and the formal sentencing or setting of a trial date, which was eventually set for October 19th. On the same date, January 2nd, Butts was arraigned on five counts of murder in addition to three counts of robbery. The date of Butts' formal plea was delayed by Judge Letham until January 7th. 4 days after his formal plea before Judge Letham, Butts committed suicide by hanging himself with a towel in his cell. A subsequent coroner's investigation revealed Butts had unsuccessfully attempted to take his own life on at least four occasions prior to his arrest. His attorney, Joe Ingber, theorized that Butts' depressive state had been magnified by the impending release of transcripts of his client's testimony at the preliminary hearing in which Butts had graphically described the torture the victims had endured prior to their murders. Prior to Bonin's impending trials, Miley and Murnau had agreed to testify against him at the trials in exchange for being spared the death penalty, with Deputy District Attorney Sterling Norris also agreeing to seek the dismissal of additional charges of sodomy and robbery filed against Murnau if he honored his agreement to testify. In the case of Miley, Norris agreed to accept two separate pleas of guilty to first-degree murder in exchange for two consecutive sentences of life imprisonment, with the possibility of parole after 25 years, if Miley agreed to testify against Bonin at the trials. Prior to his suicide, Butts never formally agreed to either testify against Bonin or to accept any form of plea bargaining. Well, I must say bravo to him for saving the taxpayers some money and just ending it after, you know, the jig's up. You did a bunch of horrible shit. You have no purpose in the world anymore. Thank you and good night.
You really didn't think that there was going to be a Hallmark ending on this one. I thought it was going to drag out, in addition to doing such pain to all of the victims, to then have to have taxpayers go through the pain of giving you justice or equal innocent until proven guilty. So yeah. Thank you very much, fine sir, for saving us that.
It could have been the end to a Hallmark Hall of Fame movie. And not Hallmark Channel, Hallmark Hall of Fame. I'm talking the 1980s, 1990s Hallmark movies that actually were really well done. And they didn't star Lori Loughlin in all of them or Candace Cameron. It was, you know, they were on television. It was kind of an event. It was like, oh, the Hallmark Hall of Fame movie is on tonight. Let's watch it. And it'd be like, I don't know, like Sarah Plain and Tall or something.
But, Hallmark Hall of Fame.
Yeah. that back when like they would put made for TV, because there used to be a thing called made for TV movies, kids, and they were usually pretty bad. And oftentimes kind of played off of something that was theatrically being done at the time. Like there was Twister in the theaters and there was like Tornado on ABC or something. And every once in a while, Hallmark would then release a movie. This is prior to there being all these movies made for cable television. That was almost unheard of at the time. And they would put out a movie, but it was really well produced. They had budgets. It wasn't quite Hollywood, but it was pretty damn close. And there were some really well-done movies back in those days. Now, Hallmark just kind of, you know, throws them out like Skittles. But you remember those at all? Maybe it was just me that ended up watching them because my mom wanted to watch them.
I don't remember Hallmark Hall of Fame. I remember after-school specials.
Mm-hmm.
I remember more on the animated side, the Disney afternoon, when you would get home from school, you would not do your homework. You would sit on the couch, have some cereal for late lunch, early dinner, and watch 2 hours of cartoons. But Hallmark Hall of Fame, and I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
I now have plans the rest of the day.
Look up, find some of them online. There's another made-for-TV movie that I remember watching back in the day. It starred, who's the actor that played Dookie Hauser?
Neil
Patrick Harris, and he played it was a made for TV movie, but it was actually pretty good, and it was based on a true story where him and his wife and their child are driving through a blizzard and they break down, and he has to walk to try and find help through the blizzard, and they hide in a cave, the mom and the daughter or the child, and in the end, like, they lose all their toes and shit from hypothermia, but they survive.
Snowbound.
There you go.
Jim and Jennifer Stolfa story.
Yeah, there you go. That's another made-for-TV movie. Anyway, back to the William George.
January 9th, 1994.
Who can forget the Hallmark Hall of Fame movie, though, about William George Bonin? I mean,
yeah,
I have to say, go ahead.
Guest stars Harry and Pew and Butts. And
I have to say, the casting of David Hasselhoff was really well done. I thought that he played
really
a very good William George.
Really to a T.
Yeah.
Stuntman had it coming.
It's interesting. I mean, to think about if something like this would have been made into. I'm surprised. This is a pretty horrific crime spree, and we know about other ones like Dahmer and all that sort of shit. I mean, I knew we grew up in that area, but everybody around the country knew the Dahmer story. Why did we not know about this one? This was only a few years prior. Was it because this guy was killing runaways, hitchhikers, people that otherwise, you know, I guess a lot of times, you know, society had already kind of not paid attention to? And is that what it was? I'm just surprised that this wasn't a bigger, or I guess more well-known.
That's a very good question. It 1980, so this is about a 10-year difference of Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yeah.
I don't know. I had never heard of this gentleman and the magnitude and level of killings and the absolute dismemberment of his victims. You would think that he was a more household name of sorts. So I don't know. Maybe because this is just in California. We grew up in the Midwest part of the country. And it just happened in a time where news did not spread as fast as it does today.
Yeah, there were no internets at that moment to do this. But in the end, Bonin is sentenced to death. I'm just scrolling through here because this entry goes on and on and on and on and on and on into his hobbies and things that he did in prison. But eventually he does die and he is executed. In California. The method of Bonin's execution was superseded with lethal injection by the state of California in 1992, following the execution of Robert Alton Harris, the first inmate California had executed since 1967. Harris had been exhibiting evident symptoms of discomfort for up to 4 minutes during his 15-minute execution in the gas chamber. These symptoms included convulsions as such, and the state of California opted to use lethal injection as an alternate method of execution to the gas chamber, branding the gas chamber a cruel and unusual method of execution. And that is how he was taken out. I don't know. I'm not for cruel and unusual anything, and I guess that must be, you know, civilized society saying we're not going to meet the people that we find guilty of these crimes with the same cruel and unusual things that we've charged them with. But I don't know. Part of me is like, you did all this shit. I don't really care how they kill you. Just do it. I mean, just the torment that this person caused so many people. I mean, in their last minutes on Earth, what they went through. And then the families of these people, too. I mean, even if some of them were runaways and such, you know, a lot of times people come back and things like that. And to know that, you know, well, so-and-so's out there, they're, you know, they'll come back sometime. But no, that never got a chance to happen. The families and such never had a chance to make that peace because it was stolen from them by this monster that has no, I mean, he talks about going on killing sprees on Saturday nights like they're going to go get Buffalo Wild Wings. It's just like, how? How does this man function? Or how did, I don't know.
Speaking of wings, what is your last meal before you get killed?
Gosh, I don't know. I haven't really contemplated that. What would you go with?
Well, while I think of what I would go with, we find out that this fine gentleman wanted and received two large pizzas, three pints of ice cream, and three six-packs of Coke.
Do you actually consume all of that? That's a lot. I mean, even on a normal day when you're not about to be killed, I don't know how you could consume that much.
Well, three pints, so not three quarts of ice cream, not three half gallons of ice cream,
okay.
Three pints. And then three six-packs of Coke. I mean, if you're thirsty, pop a six-pack down, which then only makes you thirstier. And, I mean, if you're going to die, I think I could put it down.
The thing is, doesn't the body continue to, doesn't it then excrete these things too? So you gotta somewhat consider the mortician who has to take part in this. They got to be fucking cringing. Like, okay, you're the one that's going to take care of this guy once he's gone. What did he have to eat?
Couldn't he gone with kale, maybe a smoothie?
He had two pizzas, a total of 18 Cokes, three pints of ice cream, and he insisted on eating a live squirrel head.
Hey, look, he's still alive. Run free, little Christopher.
I think I would probably do, I don't know, something that it would probably be like something like pizza or chicken nuggets, some sort of like comfort food that, you know, I would eat today as comfort food. I don't think I'd have an appetite if I knew I was about to die. I don't know. Maybe you make peace with it because people sit on death row for fucking decades. So maybe by the time it actually comes around, you have an appetite and you could eat. It's not usually like, oh, you're sentenced to death and it's going to be in 3 weeks. Pick out what you want to eat. You probably got a good amount of time to figure that one out and work that appetite up. But
if in that mindset, when I have come to peace with realizing that I'm going to die, I would probably relive my childhood, which of course was amazing, because if I then went on to become an adult who did such crazy things to then be killed, I would find the joy in my childhood, which there probably wasn't a lot, but whatever I would use as a comfort food, whether it was the Golden Arches or pizza rolls, I'd get a palette of that. And I'd have them bring it in from Costco and I would enjoy it my final evening.
A pallet of pizza rolls from Costco.
All of them. I'm going to eat them. I'm going to lather myself in them. I'm going to fucking sleep in them. I don't care. You're going to kill me tomorrow. What are you going to do? Kill me? Yeah.
And there you are in a bathtub of pizza rolls.
Oh, sorry, officer. I was just preparing myself for death.
Some people meditate. Some people find God. You found pizza rolls and a bathtub. Well, you know, to each their own. Or a hot pocket. I haven't had a hot pocket in a long time. I got to put a grocery order in. Now you've inspired me. I think I'm going to get some hot pockets and some pizza rolls in my next order.
Don't use them as soap. Eat them. Don't use them as soap.
Yes, that is a good thing to do and always understand, especially the ones that are kind of flaky and crumbly. You don't want the croissant type hot pocket. Those do not work in the shower.
Or the lean pockets. Like it's something that's not good for you that they try to make healthy, and it just the consistency. It's more of a body wash opposed to a bar of soap.
Okay, how on earth did we start talking about using Hot Pockets as soap?
Narcotics.
That was a fun twist there.
This has been a True Crime Today Dark Side Flashback. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our new episodes every Monday, Tuesday, and Friday. Breaking news stories.
Why have I asked my HVAC guy I found on Angie.com to change my grandpa's trachea tube? Because I was so amazed by how quickly he replaced our air ducts. I knew I could trust him to change Pop-Pop's tube while I was on vacation.
Make it quick, young man.
Aw, see? Pop-Pop trusts you.
I think we should call a doctor.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
When I first heard the words, you have lung cancer, I was in shock.
This week on a special episode of Health Discovered, we're taking a closer look at a common form of lung cancer that accounts for 85% of all cases.
I'm Janet Freeman Daly, and I've been living with non-small cell lung cancer since 2011.
Non-small cell lung cancer. It's a diagnosis that changes everything, and yet the conversation around it too often stops at the biology and misses what patients are actually living through every single day.
There are some things you used to be able to do that you can't do anymore. It's easy to become depressed when you're dealing with all those losses. So mental health plays a really big role.
So what does it really mean to advocate for yourself when you're living with non-small cell lung cancer? Listen to Health Discovered on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Daily Briefs.
Don't you wish everything was more rewarding? With Rakuten, almost everything is. You can earn cash back on those new shoes you've been wanting. You can save on the next trip you book. You can cash in on groceries. Just join, shop your favorite brands, and save. Target, Instacart, Expedia, Macy's, Sephora, CVS, the list is long. Save online, in-store, and at over 22,000 restaurants. And when it's time to redeem those rewards, get your money exactly how you want it. Choose PayPal, check, Bilt points, or cash out with gift cards. Eligible American Express card members can choose to earn membership rewards points instead of cash back. Terms and conditions apply. So go ahead, take a trip, fill a cart, order dessert. Rakuten is a world of rewards. Join today for free. Go to Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app. That's Rakuten.
When I first heard the words, you have lung cancer, I was in shock.
This week on a special episode of Health Discovered, we're taking a closer look at a common form of lung cancer that accounts for 85% of all cases.
I'm Janet Freeman Daly, and I've been living with non-small cell lung cancer since 2011.
Non-small cell lung cancer. It's a diagnosis that changes everything. And yet, the conversation around it too often stops at the biology and misses what patients are actually living through every single day.
There are some things you used to be able to do that you can't do anymore. It's easy to become depressed when you're dealing with all those losses. So mental health plays a really big role.
So what does it really mean to advocate for yourself when you're living with non-small cell lung cancer? Listen to Health Discovered on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
From True Crime Today.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Here's the truth. You could literally be adored by everyone and then come home and still get completely ignored by your own cat. It's classic cat behavior. But new Shiba Premium Puree is a lickable treat that changes all that. They're protein-rich, made with bone broth, and have the smooth, creamy texture cats go crazy for, especially when it's hand-fed. Yeah, it's more than a treat. It's a fast pass to favorite human status. So feed your cat Shiba and go from totally ignored to truly adored in just 12 days, guaranteed, or your money back. Learn more at Shiba.com.